capable of love acts the way he does. I never thought I would marry for love. I'm not naive enough for such daydreams. My parents grew to love and respect each other through their arrangement, and I hoped for that at least. Of course, Maven makes that hope impossible. I've had only small glimpses into his heart, and they are enough to know that his heart is dead. If the Bracken children were not our objective, if I actually hoped to maintain my Norton crown, I might entertain the idea of killing Mare Barrow. Not for spite, but to hopefully give Maven some clarity. She is a motivation now, a carrot for him to follow. But she is a weakness, too. And I need him weak. I need him distracted. As Mother said, Maven Kalor will face the Flood. They all will. The military contingent left 10 minutes ago, their transports screaming up the mountain. I can still hear the echoes coming down the slope, reverberating through the streets and alleys of the Montfort capital. The rest of the city clangs with alarm bells and warning signals, just as planned. I blink, still shrouded in Sentinel Haven's impenetrable shadow. The observatory guards abandon their posts to assist the city, leaving behind a skeleton shift of 2 Montfort soldiers. At night, their green uniforms seem black. They stand out against the polished moonstone columns, holding up the spangled dome of stained glass. Without a singer or a whisper to wipe the memories of both guards, we have no choice but to slip by them instead. It isn't difficult, but I hold my breath as we do, weaving through the observatory columns. They flank the entrance, still and steady, accustomed to the clanging alarms. Raider attacks are common, I'm told, and of little threat to the capital.
"On the plane,"
one says to the other, turning his face. His compatriot shakes her head. "On the slopes. They hit the plains twice last month." The mail guard grins, shoving his hand in his pocket.
"Plane. Betcha 10 coppers.
"Don't you get tired of losing your money to me?" she replies. As they laugh, grins wide, I press my hand to the lock of the door. With my other hand, I flick open the canteen holstered at my side. Under Sentinel Haven's power, I can't see what I'm doing, and so must rely on touch. It complicates things, but only enough to slow me down. The water swirls around my wrist, kissing my skin, before worming between my fingers and into the keyhole. It fits to the mechanism, filling the space as I exhale. Through the water, I press along the tumblers of the lock, touching each one, forming a key of my own making. I nudge sideways with my foot, reaching for Jadansa. She nudges back. Some yards away, a tree branch cracks under her ability, crashing to the paved stone, perfectly masking the sound of a turning lock.
"Raiders in the city?"
the female guard says, her laughter replaced by panic.
"No bet," the man responds.
They rush to investigate, leaving us to slip into the observatory undetected, unseen, unlooked for. Wary of any kind of security cameras, Sentinel Haven keeps us shrouded as we enter.
"Leyron, through," whispers the Norton nymph.
We sound off in turn, unable to see one another.
"Jadansa."
"Rydal."
"Nero."
"Iris."
"Delos,"
says the Haven Sentinel. Grinning, I ease the door shut behind us. Infiltrate the observatory prison. Done. I don't allow myself a sigh of relief. That won't come until I'm on the ground at home, with Bracken's children safely returned. And even that is premature. As Mother would say, no use sleeping while there are wars to be won. And we certainly have a war exploding around us. Jadansa's footsteps echo slightly as she rounds the room. Her search takes several long minutes, enough to put us on edge. The tension ratchets with the passing seconds until she returns. I can hear the smile in her voice.
"They are truly foolish," she says. "No cameras, not one."
"How can that be?" I hear Leyron mutter.
My teeth grit together.
"Perhaps they don't want a record of the children being here," I reply, giving the only explanation I can think of. It shouldn't affect me. Horrible things are done in war, even to Silvers. I know that firsthand.
Or what they've done to them.
The realization settles over us, another curtain of dread upon the pile. I raise my chin, smoothing my unseen hair, tucking pieces behind my ears.
Sentinel Haven, you may cease.
Yes, Your Majesty.
I can hear him bow, and then I see it. We bleed into vision, all of us at once, as if a window has suddenly been wiped clean. Most look at their own limbs, examining themselves. But Nero is staring at me. He looks paler in the dim light filtering through the glass dome, which dapples his face in sickly green. His gaze feels like a challenge, or perhaps an amusement. I dislike either option.
This way,
I tell them, focusing on the task at hand. They fall into line, even Nero, and I'm glad to have Judansa on my heels. The Sentinel, too. I'm the Queen of Norta, and he has sworn to protect me as well as Maven. We round a massive telescope, pointed at the domed roof, made of tubes of brass and glass fixtures. A waste, I think. The stars are well beyond the reach of anyone, even Silvers. They are the realm of gods and gods alone. They are not for us to fathom. To try is to squander time, resources, and energy. Several chambers lead off the round central room, but we ignore them. Instead, I cross the floor, searching the marble beneath my feet for visible cracks. I don't expect any, and loose the canteen again. With a nod at Leiron, I have him do the same. Our water spreads around our feet and across the marble, expanding to the thinnest of covers. It prods and puddles over the stone, working into grooves and seams between the slabs.
Here, Leiron says, taking a few steps toward the wall.
His own water bunches up like a giant droplet. As I approach, squinting, I can see tiny air bubbles trailing up through the water. There is open space below. Judansa makes quick work of the slab, drawing it up and out of place with a wave of her fingers. Beneath, darkness looms, but not blackness. There are lights in the chamber below the observatory, somewhere farther down the passage. Enough to see by, but not to bleed through the tiny seams of the trapdoor slab. Stairs lead downward, as if beckoning. Rydal goes first, according to our plan, with Nero behind, one hand on his holstered gun, should Rydal meet opposition. Sentinel Haven follows. I notice that his hands seem to darken, pooling with shadow like curling smoke. I keep close on his heels, with Judansa at my side and Leiron bringing up the rear.
This is the easy part, I tell myself. And I'm right.
The passage curves, tracking below the observatory and beyond its bounds. There are no guards, no cameras. Nothing but the dim lights and the echo of our own feet. I wonder if this place was made specifically for Prince Bracken's children. Somehow I doubt it. The stone is old, though the walls are freshly painted the warm color of butter. It has an odd, calming effect I wouldn't expect for enemy prisoners. The Montfortins are strange indeed. About 100 yards on, the passage widens into some kind of receiving chamber, walled by a bank of windows. I balk at them, looking out onto the glimmer of the city. The windows must be thick, because I can't hear any alarms, though I still see the lights of them flashing up and down ascendant. I exchange a confused glance with Judansa, who looks just as puzzled as I feel. She shrugs and jerks her chin to our right, where the chamber dead-ends at a single door. It is unremarkable, not even reinforced that I can see. When I lay my palm against the lock, intending to key it open again, I realize why.
"Silent stone," I hiss, drawing back as if burned.
Just the distant ache of the ability's smothering weapon makes my skin crawl.
"Torturous bastards!"
Judansa makes a disgusted sound deep in her throat.
"Those poor children! It's been months!"
The others echo her sentiment.
All but one. "Bad for them, good for us," Nero says without any kind of sympathy.
I round on him, sneering.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
I growl.
Silent Stone will have made them lethargic, sleepy. No one will notice when these two don't move in the morning, he says, poking at the covered bulk on Rydell's back.
His fingers tap against human flesh with little regard. Right as he may be, I still scowl.
Let's get them out, I say, snapping my fingers. Sentinel Haven, your assistance, please. And Nero, be ready to heal them. They'll need it.
I know what a prison of silent stone does to a person. I saw it firsthand in Barrow. Her sunken cheeks and dull eyes, the way her bones jutted, her cold skin veined with sickness. And she was a stubborn hellion, feeding on fury to keep herself sane, with a cause to hold on to, albeit a foolish, doomed one. Prince Bracken's children are young, only 10 and 8 years old. Silver's born, reliant on their ability, with no memory of life without. I don't want to know what the Silent Stone has done to them, but I have no choice. I must look into the face of war's horrors and never blink. My father did not. My mother and sister do not. I have to keep my eyes open if I can ever hope to win. Win and go home.
Laron opens this door, using his own canteen to form a watery key. It takes him a bit longer, battling the edges of silent stone. Finally, he swings open the door and steps back, allowing me to enter first. I shudder as I step inside, steeling myself against the unnatural sensation. It's more uniform than fighting with a silence. Their abilities pulse with their hearts and concentration. This is constant, unyielding. I swallow hard against the ugly, unnatural sensation. In spite of my team at my back, waiting in the blissful safety of the passage, I feel more vulnerable than ever, a newborn baby exposed on a cliff. The children sleep soundly, each one tucked into a nicely made bed. I glance around, expecting some kind of guard in the shadows. There's nothing but the dim silhouettes of a well-furnished room and curtained windows. As in the passage, they look out through the pines and down into the city valley. Another torture, to see the world beyond your reach.
Help me carry them out, I mutter, eager to be rid of this place.
I reach for the dark-haired child in the bed closest to me, putting a hand to her face, ready to clamp my fingers over her mouth, should she scream. Bracken's daughter shifts at my touch, but doesn't wake. In the dim light, her skin is the color of polished jet.
Wake up, Charlotta, I murmur.
My heartbeat doubles.
We need to go.
Sentinel Haven is not so steady with Prince Michael. He slides one arm behind his shoulders and another under his knees before scooping him up. Like his sister, the boy is slow to wake, groggy, sluggish. The silent stone has wreaked its havoc upon them both.
Who?
The boy mumbles, his eyes fluttering open and shut. Beneath me, his sister stirs, roused as I shake her shoulders gently. She blinks up at me, brows knitting in confusion.
Is it time for our walk?
She asks, her voice high and breathy.
We won't fuss, promise.
Yes, I tell her quickly, seizing the opportunity. We're going to go for a walk away from the stone, but you both have to be very quiet and do exactly as we say. It isn't a lie, and it energizes both of them as much as possible. Charlotta even wraps her arms around my neck, allowing me to lift her. She's lighter than I expected, more like a bird than a girl. She smells fresh, clean. I would think the children well-treated if not for the Silent Stone. Michael curls in Sentinel Haven's arms.
You're new,
he says up to the Sentinel. I can't get out of the room fast enough, and I suck in a healing breath as we step back into the passage. The children both exhale, and Charlotta relaxes in my arms.
Remember, do as we say, I mumble, averting my eyes from what Rydell and Nero have prepared.
The boy nods, wordless, but the girl looks up at me with a keen glance I wouldn't expect from a child.
Are you rescuing us?
She whispers. I see no reason to lie. The words stick anyway, because I might fail. I might get them killed. I might die in this attempt.
Yes, I force out,
Let me see them.
Nero wastes no time, flashing a light in both their faces that startles even me.
Quiet, I murmur when Michael yelps.
I glare at Nero over the girl's head, but he ignores me, turning his focus on them. His eyes dart back and forth like some kind of ticking machine as he memorizes their features. When he turns back to the bundle on the ground, I can't look away fast enough. Still, I catch the sight of them, the two little red bodies. They are still breathing, heavily drugged, already too far gone to wake up without aid, but still breathing. Nero needs living flesh to do his work. Sentinel Haven catches my eye, and he turns as I do, putting his back to the skin healer and the reds. We can't let the children see what is being done for them, and we don't want to watch it happen. Weakness, something whispers in me when I flinch at the sound of a blade singing out of its sheath. Keep your eyes open, Iris Signet.
Such artistry, I hear Nero tell himself, his voice wolfish and full of glee.
His work is mostly silent. Mostly.
11. Mare. I barely slept, despite my exhaustion. It took us almost until dawn to get back to Ascendant, the healers working on us along the way. When we arrived, we only had a few hours until Davidson's planned address to his assembled government. I tried to sleep, but by the time the adrenaline from the raider battle wore off, I was racked with nerves for the coming meeting. I spent what was left of the night staring at the edges of my curtains, watching the blue light of pre-dawn grow. Now, I can barely sit still as I wait on the lower terrace, fussing with the edges of my dress. It is a harsh gown, a deep, spangled purple, belted in gold at my waist, with ballooning sleeves gathered at the wrists. The collar plunges, showing the edge of Maven's brand, and I braided my hair back away from my face. I proudly display the scars branching down my neck. My idea, not Gisa's. I want to show the Montfort politicians how much I've already sacrificed, and I want to look like as much of the Lightning Girl as I can, even if that person isn't real. I can draw strength from her, as I draw strength from Marina, too. They may be false versions of myself, but they are also pieces of someone real, however small. The sunrise is strange in the mountains. It spreads behind me, sending jagged rays of light up and over the peaks. Slowly but steadily, darkness bleeds from the valley, fleeing with the morning mist along the slopes of the city. Ascendant seems to wake up with the light, and the low hum of activity buzzes up to the palace. Queen Annabelle is not one to be late, especially for something as important as this. She descends from the palace entrance, her grandson and their guards close at hand. Julian hangs back a bit, arms folded into his long golden robes. He meets my eye and nods in greeting. I return the gesture. I might not agree with his choosing to back his nephew, but I understand the choice. I understand supporting family over everything else. In her Larilan colors, red and flaming orange, Annabelle seems more like a sentinel guarding her king than his grandmother. She is just as deadly. She doesn't wear a gown, but a brocaded coat, with a matching tunic and black leggings beneath, their hems set with glinting bronze like pieces of armor. Annabelle Larilan is ready for the kind of battle not fought on the field. Her smile at me across the terrace does not meet her eyes. Your Majesty, I say, greeting her with a dip of my head. Tiberius, I add, my eyes flicking to him. He smirks to himself, darkly amused by my refusal to call him anything else. Not his nickname, not even his title. Good morning, he replies. He looks handsome as ever, perhaps more so. The raider battle hangs on him, and I can almost smell the ash he spent the night scrubbing away. Maybe don't think about him bathing, I snap to myself. The dawn suits the Fire Prince, in his scarlet cloak and raven silk underclothes. He has his crown on his neat black hair, magnetron made I bet. Another of Evangeline's creations. It suits him, too. No jewels, no intricacies. Just a simple band of raw iron sculpted like a braid of flame. I trace it with my eyes, focusing on such a small thing that he loves so much. While there is still a hissing tension between us, I don't feel the same anger or rage I did yesterday. Our words on the mountain, few as they were, had some calming effect. I wish we had more time to come to some sort of understanding. But what understanding can there be? Try as I might, I can't stamp out the hope still burning in my heart. I still want him to choose me. And I would still forgive him if he admitted his mistake. That hope refuses to die, stupid as it might be. Farley's appearance shocks me most of all. Not because her leg is healed, good as new. That I expected. She follows the immaculate Premier Davidson out, and at first I don't recognize her. Gone is the battered uniform, her dark red coveralls stained by use and worn by battle. This is a dress uniform instead, more akin to something I've seen Tiberius or Maven wear. Never Farley. I blink at her, watching her adjust the sleeves of the snug crimson coat, intimately tailored to her form. Her general's badges are fastened at the collar, three iron squares set in the fabric. There are others on her breast, medals and honors, both metal and ribbon. I doubt they're real, but they make her look impressive. Clearly, Davidson and Carmadon helped her dress for the meeting, working to legitimize the Scarlet Guard through her. Add to that the scar at the corner of her mouth and the hard steel of her blue eyes, and I wonder how any politicians might deny what she asks for. General Farley, I say, offering her a crooked smirk. Nice outfit. Careful, Barrow, before I force you into one of these two, she grumbles, fighting her sleeves again. I can barely move in this thing. The jacket runs tight across her shoulders, perfectly fitted, but not enough to allow the kind of movement she's used to, the kind of movement required in a fight. I glance at her hips, snug and equally tailored pants tucked into boots. No gun? Farley scowls. Don't remind me. To the surprise of no one, Evangeline Samos arrives last. She glides through the grand oak doors, her Samos cousins flanking her in matching gray coats and black trim. Evangeline's gown is blinding white, fading to deep, inky black at the sleeves and long train. As she grows closer, I realize that the silk of her dress isn't dyed, but patterned with chips of resplendent, shimmering metal, in a perfect shift from pearly white to gray steel to black iron. She approaches with purpose, letting the gown spread behind her, hissing over the green and white stones.
If only we could replicate such an entrance in the People's Gallery, Davidson mutters to Farley and me.
He watches Evangeline approach. She squares her shoulders, letting the ramrod of determination mark her steps. The Premier himself keeps to his plain but splendid persona, clad in a dark green suit with white enamel buttons. His gray hair gleams, slicked back against his head.
"Shall we?" he says, gesturing to the arches leading away from the palace. In our varying colors and varying degrees of readiness, we follow him down the winding steps into the city. I wish the walk were longer, but the People's Gallery, the building where the entire Montfort government gathers for matters such as this, isn't far. Just a few hundred yards down the slope, set onto more terraces cut below the Premier's palace. Again, there are no walls to defend such an important place. Only white stone archways and sweeping verandas surround the domed building overlooking Ascendant and the valley. The sun continues to rise, gleaming off the green glass dome hundreds of feet across. The glass is too flawed to be silver made, but it is more beautiful for the whorls and curves of imperfection, which catch the light in more interesting ways than flat, meticulous panes of pure glass. Silver-barked aspen trees with golden leaves spring up at even intervals, lining the structure like living columns. Those are the work of silvers, Green wardens, no doubt. Soldiers flank each tree, still in their dark greens. Proud, unyielding. We cross the long marble walkway to the wide-open doors of the gallery. I take a breath, steeling myself. This shouldn't be difficult. Montfort is not our enemy, and our objective is clear. Acquire an army, as much as we can. Overthrow a mad king and his allies, all of them hell-bent on maintaining their power, at the cost of red and new blood life. Agreeing to help should be easy for the Free Republic of Montfort. Isn't equality what they stand for? Or so I've been told. Gritting my teeth, I reach out and grab Farley's hand. I squeeze her calloused fingers just for a second. Without hesitation, she squeezes back. The first hall is columned, hung with green and white silks, gathered with silver and red ties. The colors of Montfort, and the colors of both kinds of blood. Sunlight beams down from skylights, filling the space with an ethereal glow. Many chambers branch off, visible through arches between the columns or locked behind polished oak doors. And of course, there are people in the hall, clustered together, their eyes on all of us as we pass. Men and women, red and silver, their skin a vast array of hues, ranging from porcelain to midnight. I try to feel armored in my skin, protected from their gaze. Ahead of me, Tiberius holds his head high, his grandmother on his right arm, while Evangeline takes his left. She is careful to keep in step with his long stride. No daughter of House Samos walks behind. Her gown's train forces Farley and me to keep our distance. Not that I mind. Julian walks behind us both. I can hear him muttering to himself as he looks back and forth. I'm surprised he doesn't take notes. The People's Gallery is aptly named. As we approach the entrance to the chamber, I hear the low hum of hundreds of voices. It rises quickly until it drowns out everything but the thunder of my own pulse in my ears. Massive doors of white and green enamel glide open on oiled hinges, as if bowing before the will of Premier Davidson. He enters to the cascading noise of applause. It spreads as we follow into the amphitheater that is the gallery. Hundreds crowd the many seats ringing the room, most of them in suits like Davidson's, in varying shades of green and white. Some are military, clearly marked by dress uniforms and insignia. All rise when we enter, their hands clapping together to celebrate. Us? Or the Premier? I don't know. Some don't clap, but they still stand, out of either respect or tradition. The steps down the bowl of the amphitheater are shallow. I could run them with my eyes closed. Even so, I keep my focus on my feet and the folds of my shimmering dress. Davidson reaches the floor of the chamber, making for his own seat at the center, flanked by still-standing politicians. There are empty chairs for us as well, each one marked by a drape of colored cloth. Orange for Annabelle, silver for Evangeline, purple for me, scarlet for Farley, and so forth. While Davidson greets the men and women on the floor, shaking hands with an open, charismatic grin, we take to our chairs. No matter how many times people put me on parade, I never get used to it. Not so for Evangeline. She sits next to me, arranging the falling folds of her dress with a flick of her hands. She raises an eyebrow. Imperious, a living painting. She was born for moments like this, and if she is afraid of them, she will never show it. "Kill that fear, Lightning Girl," she mutters to me, fixing me with an electric stare. "It's not like you haven't done this before." "True," I whisper back, remembering Maven, his throne, and all the vile things I said at his side. "This will be easy in comparison. This won't rip me apart." Davidson doesn't sit down, watching as the others in the room take their seats in thunderous unison. He clasps his hands before him, bowing his head. A lock of gray hair falls over his eyes. "Before we begin, I would like to observe a moment of silence for those who fell last night, defending our people from raider attack. They will be remembered." All over the room, his politicians and officers nod approvingly, before lowering their own heads. Some close their eyes, I'm not sure which is appropriate, so I mimic the premiere, knitting my fingers together and dipping my chin. After what feels like an eternity, Davidson raises his head again.
My fellow countrymen, he says, his voice carrying across the amphitheater with ease. Something about the room, I suspect, built to maximize acoustics. I would like to thank you, both for agreeing to this special session of the People's Gallery, and for showing up. He pauses, grinning at the responding wave of polite laughter. The bland joke is an easy tool. I can pick out exactly who his supporters are, simply by how much they laugh or grin. A few politicians remain stoic. To my surprise, they are both red and silver, judging by the undertones of their skin. Davidson pushes on, pacing as he speaks. As we're all aware, our nation is a young one, built by our own hands over the last 2 decades. I am only the 3rd premier, and many of you are in your 1st terms of office. Together, we represent the will of our diverse people and their interests, and of course, we work to provide for their safety. In the past months, I have done what I've thought is necessary to uphold what our country is and to safeguard what our country strives to be. His face turns stern, the lines on his forehead deepening. A beacon of freedom. A hope. A light in the darkness surrounding us. Montfort is a country, the only one on this continent, where the color of blood does not rule. Where red and silver and ardent work in tandem, hand in hand, to build a better future for all of our children. My knuckles turn white in my lap as I squeeze my hands together. The country Davidson speaks of, what it represents. Could it really be possible? A year ago, Mayor Barrow, knee-deep in the mud of the stilts, would not have believed it. Could not have. I was constrained both by what I was taught and by the only world I was allowed to see. My life was limited to the bounds of work or conscription, each a different kind of doom. Both lives already lived by thousands, millions. There was no use dreaming that life could be different. It would only break an already broken heart. It's cruel to give hope where none should be. My father told me that. And even he would never say it again. Not now, when we've seen that hope is real. And this place, this step toward a better world, is somehow real too. I see it before my eyes. Red representatives with their blooming flushes alongside silver. A new blood leader walking the floor before us. Farley, her blood red as the dawn, sitting so close to a silver king. And even me, I'm here too. My voice matters. My hope matters. I glance across Evangeline to the true king of Norta. He followed me here because he still loves me, a red girl, and because he truly does try to see things for himself. I hope he sees what I see here, and if he does take the throne, if we are unable to stop him, I hope he hears what the premier is saying. He looks at his hands, his fingers clawed on the arms of his seat. His knuckles are just as white as mine. And yet, we cannot claim to be free, we cannot claim to be any kind of beacon, if we allow atrocity on our borders. Davidson continues. He stalks toward the lower seats, gazing at each politician in turn. If we can look at the horizon and know there are reds living as slaves, ardents slaughtered, lives crushed beneath the feet of silver overlords. The royal silvers with us do not flinch, but they don't do anything to deny what the premier is saying either. Annabelle, Tiberius, and Evangeline keep their eyes forward, their expressions locked in place. Davidson paces back, completing a circle of the floor. 1 year ago, I petitioned for the ability to interfere, to use a fraction of our armies to aid the Scarlet Guard in their infiltration of Norta, the Lakelands, and Piedmont, all kingdoms built on tyranny. It was a risk. It exposed our nation,
which had been growing in secret. But you graciously agreed. He steeples his fingers, half bowing to the gallery. And so I ask again, for more soldiers, more money, for the ability to overthrow murderous regimes, and for the right to look ourselves in the face, so we can tell our children we did not stand by and watch as children just like them were murdered or condemned. It is our duty to witness and to fight now that we can. In the seats of the gallery, one of the politicians stands, a silver man with wispy blonde hair, bone-white skin, and robes of deep emerald green. His nails are oddly long and polished to a high shine. "You speak of overthrowing a regime, Premier," he says. "But I see beside you a young man with silver blood and a crown upon his head. I see no other crowns in this room. And you know as well as I do the crowns we had to destroy to forge our country, how much we had to burn to rise from the ashes." The politician touches his own brow. His meaning is clear. One of the crowns given up was his own. I clench my teeth, fighting the urge to look at Tiberius. I want to yell at him, "See, it can be done." Davidson offers a deep bow of his head. "Very true, Representative Radis. The Free Republic is a nation made from war, from sacrifice, and above all, things from opportunity. Before we rose up, the mountains were a patchwork of petty kingdoms and worse, fighting for dominance. There was no unity. It was easy to worm ourselves into the cracks and break apart what was already breaking." He pauses, eyes alight. "I see a similar opportunity now, in the Silver Kingdoms of the East, room to change things in Norta, to remake things for the better." Another politician stands from the gallery ranks, a red woman with smooth copper skin, close-cropped black hair, and a white gown crossed with an olive sash. "Does Your Majesty agree?" she asks, fixing her eyes on Tiberius. He hesitates, surprised at her directness. Tiberius isn't as quick with his words as his cursed brother.
"Norta is in a state of civil war," he replies, his voice wavering. "More than a third of the nation has seceded, some pledging fealty to the Kingdom of the Rift, where my betrothed's father is king."
Clenching his jaw, he gestures to Evangeline next to him. She doesn't react.
"The rest are pledged to me, to putting me back on my own father's throne and casting out my brother." A muscle jumps in his cheek. "Who murdered his way to it?"
Tiberius lowers his eyes, slowly. I can see his chest rising and falling rapidly beneath the folds of his red cape. The thought of Maven still wounds us both, Tiberius even more than me. I was there when Maven and Alara forced him to murder his own father, the old king. I see that terrible moment written on his grim face, clear as letters in a book. The representative is not satisfied. She tips her head, bringing long fingers together.
"Reports say that King Maven is beloved among the people. The ones still loyal to him, I mean," she adds. "Curious that the red populace of Norta is counted in that regard."
A low current of heat ripples across my exposed skin. Not a lot, but enough to communicate Tiberius's discomfort. I curl my fingers into a fist, speaking before he is forced to. "King Maven is greatly skilled in manipulation," I tell the woman. "He easily uses his own image, the boy king forced to the throne, and tricks anyone who doesn't truly know him. And sometimes even those who do. Tiberius, most of all. He told me once he was looking for new blood whispers, stronger than Queen Alara, perhaps able to fix what she broke in his brother. An impossible wish, a terrible dream. I've seen Maven without her machinations. She is dead, and he is still the monster she forced him to be." The politician turns her eyes on me, and I continue. He brokered the Lakeland Alliance, ending a war my people were sent to fight. He lifted the restrictions his father made on their lives. It isn't hard to understand why he has support. It's easy to win the favor of the people you feed. As I speak, I think about myself, my family, the Stilts, Cameron, and the slum towns full of Reds trapped to their lives. Where would we be if someone had not broken through the wall around us, shown us how the world really should be? Especially when you control what they are given, both on the table and on the video screen. She grins at me, showing gapped teeth.
You've been a thorn in his side, Mayor Barrow, and a boon to him as well. We've seen videos from your capture. Your words swayed people to him, too.
The heat I feel next isn't from Tiberius, but from my own embarrassment. It claws over my face, warming my cheeks.
Yes, and I am ashamed of it, I tell her bluntly.
On my left, Farley clenches a fist on the seat of her chair. She leans forward.
You can't blame her for things said to the business end of a gun.
The red woman tightens.
I do not, of course. But your face and your voice have been used so many times, Miss Barrow. You will be little use in trying to sway your own people back in Norta. And I apologize, but it makes it difficult to trust what you say now and who you speak for.
Then speak to me, Farley snaps, her voice echoing throughout the gallery.
My flush recedes, chased away by cool relief.
I glance sidelong, more grateful for Farley than ever before. She keeps her temper in check, using it as fuel.
I am a general of the Scarlet Guard, a high officer of command. My organization has been working in the shadows for years, from the frozen shores of the Hud to the Piedmont Lowlands, and everywhere in between. We've done very much with very little. Imagine what we can do with more.
On the opposite side of the chamber, another one of the Montfort representatives puts up a hand, winking with golden rings. He's red, his smile sharp and slick.
Much, you say. Forgive me, General, but before you began working with us, your Scarlet Guard was little more than a network of allied criminals. Smugglers, thieves, murderers even.
Farley just sniffs. We did what we had to. The Premier speaks of working through cracks. We made them. And we transported thousands out of danger. Reds who needed our help, new bloods too. Your own Premier is Norton-born, isn't he?
She points her chin at Davidson, who holds her gaze.
Nearly executed for the crime of what he was born as. We saved people like him every day.
The sly man shrugs his shoulders.
Our point is that you cannot do this alone, General, he says, and while your cause is just, accordances must be made. You are a group with no nation, no citizens to answer to. Your methods are beyond the usual bounds of war. We have our own to think of.
We answer to everyone, sir, Farley replies coolly. She turns her head just so, letting the scarred side of her mouth catch the light from the dome overhead.
Especially those who think no one is listening. We are listening, and we are doing, and we will keep fighting. To the last rattle of our last breath, the Scarlet Guard will do what it can to fix what is broken, with or without your aid.
Still pacing, Davidson passes by her. He shoots her a glance I cannot decipher, lips pressed into a neutral line, eyes locked on her face. I can't tell if he's pleased or infuriated. The silver representative named Radis stands again. He doesn't look a day over 35, and he's old enough to remember what this country was before Montfort. He eyes us all.
So you propose we support another silver monarch and help him to a throne?
On my right, Evangeline grins, and I can see she capped her eye teeth with pointed silver. Gruesome, I think to myself. And a message like the rest of her image. She will bite out the heart of anyone in her way, including all of us.
Two, actually,
she says, projecting her voice across the amphitheater. My father, the King of the Rift, must also be recognized as a legitimate ruler. A corner of Tiberius's mouth twitches, and Annabelle purses her lips. As before in Corvium, Evangeline does her best to sidetrack any progress her betrothed might make. Radis sneers back at her, gray eyes flashing. But, as you told us, Premier, he says, the Free Republic was built from such kingdoms. We know what they are, what they become. His gaze ticks from Evangeline to Tiberius. No matter how noble, how true, how honorable the king or queen. Premier Davidson's blank mask threatens to slip, betraying a frown. He bows his head slightly, acknowledging Radis's point. Others murmur around the room, ruminating on the same flaw in this alliance. Of course, Davidson and the guard have a longer game, with no intention of propping up more kings and queens, but we can't exactly argue that in front of the Silvers. The lie comes easily for me, because it isn't entirely false. You said something else before, Premier, I say quickly, pushing out of my chair. Before the Second Battle of Corvium, when we were still in Piedmont. Davidson whirls to me, an eyebrow raised. Inches for miles, I explain, sharpening each letter on my tongue. The full strength of the gallery's attention makes me shiver with desperation. They must agree. We need their support if we're going to end Maven's reign and stop Tiberius from picking up the crown he leaves behind. Change can be quick, or it can be slow, but the movement should always be forward. I know some of you look at King Tiberius, at Queen Annabelle and Princess Evangeline, and wonder, how are they different? How is spilling your own blood to give them a throne better than staying alive and letting Maven keep his? Radis looks down his long nose at me. Because you claim Maven Kalor is a monster, a wayward boy with no leash. I toss my head, flicking my braid over my shoulder. Like Farley, I let my scars tell their own story. The M on my collarbone cooks beneath 100 pairs of eyes. Because Maven Kalor is, without question, without argument, the worse option, I say, directing my words to all of them. Not only will he never move his country forward, but he will also drag Norda backward. He has no regard for red life or even silver, no thoughts of equality, not even an inkling of anything beyond his broken circle of vengeance and the desire to be loved. And unlike Tiberius, unlike King Volo in the Rift, unlike perhaps any silver monarch breathing today, he is willing to do anything to keep his crown. Slowly, Radis sits. He gestures with a white hand, asking me to continue. Not that I need his permission. Still, pride surges in me. Yes, I tell them. Under most circumstances, you would be better off staying here, protected by your mountains, insulated against the world, if you can find it in your stomachs to ignore the atrocities of Norta and her allies. Some of them squirm in their chairs. But not now. Not with the Lakelands on his side. You can take your time deciding whether to give us more aid, but that bell has already rung. You voted to help us before. Your soldiers were there when I was rescued from Whitefire Palace. Your army helped us hold the walls of Corvium. And Maven Kalor will never forget what you did. He will never forget how you stole me from him. You're like Thomas was, Maven told me once. I hear him still, muttering in my head. You are the only person I care about, the only person who reminds me I am alive, not empty, and not alone. He was a monster then, keeping me trapped in his palace, trapped inside my own skin. I wonder what kind of beast he is now, with nothing and no one but the splintered pieces in his head. I grit my teeth, trying to picture his next moves. Not in the coming days, but months from now. Years. One day, his armies will be at your door. The Nortons, the Lakelanders. They swim before my eyes, the high houses in their colors, the Lakelanders in their royal blue.
All of them with all their fury, marching behind a shield of red soldiers you'll be forced to kill. You might win, but many of your own will die with them. How many, I can't say. I can only assure you it will be more. The red woman, with black hair, tips her hand, calling for attention. She looks past me, to Farley still in her seat. "Do you agree, General?" she asks, and then points to Tiberius. "Will this Silver King be better than the one already on the throne?" Farley scoffs, all but rolling her eyes. "Ma'am, I care very little for Tiberius Calor," she replies. I can't help but wince, hissing out a breath. "Farley." But she isn't finished. "So you can believe me when I say he will be." The representative bobs her head, satisfied with such an answer. She isn't the only one. Many of the politicians around the room, both red and silver, exchange whispers. "Well, Your Majesty," the woman adds, turning her attention on Tiberius. He shifts in his chair. On his right, Annabelle touches his arm with fleeting fingers. "I have enough experience with silver mothers to know that Queen Annabelle would be considered overly maternal, too gentle, too loving with her kin." I sit as he gets up, stepping onto the floor. Davidson acquiesces, finally taking his own chair to let Tiberius stand alone. He cuts a magnificent sight against the white marble and granite, and the swirling green dome over our heads. The red of his cape seems a livid flame, a swath of fresh blood. Tiberius raises his chin.
"I've spent almost a year in exile, betrayed by my brother. But I was betrayed by my..."
He pauses, chewing the words.
"My father, as well. He raised me to be a king like every king before. Unyielding, unchanging, bound to the past, locked into endless war, married to tradition."
For the first time, Evangeline flinches, her clawed nails curling on the arms of her seat. The true king pushes on.
"The truth is, Norta was split in two long before my father was murdered. Silver overlords, with reds below. I knew it to be wrong, as we all know, in the deepest places of ourselves. But there are limits to the power of kings. I thought changing the bedrock of a country, rearranging the ills of our society, was one of them. I thought the current balance, however unfair, was better than the risk of tipping the kingdom into chaos."
His voice hums with determination.
"And I was wrong. So many people taught me that." "You were one of them, Premier," he says, glancing back at Davidson.
"And so are all of you. Your country, strange as it seems to us, is proof that new lines can be drawn. A different kind of balance can be maintained. As King of Norta, I intend to see what I couldn't before, and to do everything I can to bridge the canyons between red and silver, heal the wounds, change what must be changed." I've heard him speak eloquently before. He did it in Corvium, saying much the same thing. He swore to change the world with us, to erase the divide between red and silver. It stirred pride in me then, but not now. I know what his words mean and exactly how far his promises extend, especially with the crown in the balance. Even so, I gasp to myself when he sinks, dropping to a knee at the center of the floor. His cape pools around him, vibrant and bloody against the marble. Murmurs rise as he bows his head.
"I don't ask for anyone to fight for me, but alongside me," he says slowly.
The black-haired woman is first to speak, her head tipped to one side. "We already know you're not the kind to send another in your stead, Your Majesty," she replies. "That was made clear last night. My daughter, Captain Via, fought with you on the Hawkway." Still kneeling, Tiberius says nothing. He only nods, a muscle jumping his cheek. On the opposite side of the chamber, Radis gestures to Davidson,
flicking out one hand. As he does so, a sudden breeze rustles through the gallery. He is a windweaver, I realize.
Put it to a vote, Premier,
the silver says. In his seat, Davidson dips his chin. He stares out, searching the many assembled politicians. I wonder what he reads in their faces. After a long moment, he exhales.
Very well, Representative Raddus.
I vote yes,
Raddus says quickly, firmly, and sits. On the floor, Tiberius blinks quickly, trying to mask his surprise. I feel the same. It only grows with every resounding yes, spoken from dozens of lips. I count under my breath. 30. 35. 40. There are no's scattered among the politicians, enough at first to temper any hope I might feel, but they are quickly eclipsed, drowned out, in favor of the answer we so desperately need. Finally, Davidson grins and stands back up out of his chair. He crosses the floor and touches Tiberius lightly on the shoulder, gesturing for him to rise.
You have your army.
12. Evangeline. Even though Montfort is beautiful, I'm keenly glad to be leaving so soon after our arrival. What's more, I'm going home. To Ridge House, to Ptolemais, to Elaine. I'm so happy I barely notice that I have to pack up my things myself. It's the smart move. Even the Reds know it. The Rift is closer to Montfort than the Piedmont base, not to mention it isn't surrounded by Bracken's territory. And the kingdom is a place of strength, well defended. Maven won't order an assault on our lands, and we'll have time to gather our resources and our armies. Still, my skin prickles with discomfort all afternoon. I can hardly stomach Cal's grin as we step out into the courtyard of Davidson's palace. Sometimes I wish he had just an ounce of Maven's cunning, or even sense. Then he might understand what happened this morning in the People's Gallery. But no, he's too trusting, too good, and much too pleased with his little speech to realize how well Davidson maneuvers. The vote was already decided. It must have been. The politicians of Montfort already knew what Davidson would request, and they already knew how they would answer. The army was decided before we even arrived. Everything else, the entire visit to the city, was a performance and a seduction. It's what I would do. Just as Davidson's own words to me were a seduction of their own.
Another small thing we allow here, he said to me when I first arrived.
He knows about Elaine, and he knows exactly what to say to make me falter, make me wonder, make me think even for an instant about throwing my life away for a place here. The Premier is a good salesman, to say the least. Cal crosses the courtyard to bid goodbye to Davidson and his husband, Carmadon. Looking at the couple, I feel the familiar surge of jealousy and then nausea. I turn away, if only to look somewhere else. My eyes land on another despicable public display of emotion, another nauseating round of farewells before this troop of dancing monkeys heads to the Rift. I don't understand why Mare couldn't have said her goodbyes inside, where the rest of us didn't have to see such a performance, as if she is original in her grief, as if Mare Barrow is the only one here who has ever had to leave someone behind. She hugs her family one by one, each embrace longer than the last. Her mother cries, her father cries, her brothers and her sister cry. She does her best not to, and fails. Their half-hidden sniffles echo across the mountain jetway, and the rest of us are forced to act as if we aren't waiting for the weeping family. It's all very red, I suppose. They don't have to worry about what showing weakness might do, because for the most part, they're already weak. Someone should talk to Barrow about that. She should know by now how important maintaining an image is. The tall red boy, Barrow's tan, blonde pet, follows alongside,
hugging her family as if they were his own. I suppose he's still tagging along. Calf